Hi, I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 94 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. You can email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com, that's Crowe with an E. Like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or join the discussion there. Or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. We're on iTunes and other podcast programs, or you can listen to us live at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. And also, if you have suggestions for new guests, comments on previous shows, I definitely appreciate hearing about those. If you'd like to sponsor this show as an individual or as an advertiser, please let me know. Today's guest, James Ferguson, has been a journalist since 1989. He started working for the Independent newspaper. He's covered current affairs in Europe, North and East Africa, the Far East, the Caribbean, and especially Central Asia and Afghanistan. For 3 years, he was also the political features editor of Robert Maxwell's ill-fated newspaper, The European. From 1998 to 2000, he worked in Sarajevo as a press spokesman for the Office of the High Representative, which was charged with implementing the Dayton Peace Accord that ended the Bosnia Civil War in 1995. He then went to work for a London-based intelligence firm. His first book was published in 2004. Kandahar Cockney told the story of Mir, his Afghan fixer and interpreter, whom he helped gain political asylum in London. It was a BBC Radio 4 Book of the Week. His second book, The Vitamin Murders, is the subject of our show, so I'll save the description until a bit later. In 2008, he published A Million Bullets, The Real Story of the British Army in Afghanistan, that was the British Army's Military Book of the Year. And in 2010, he published Taliban, The True Story of the World's Most Feared Guerrilla Fighters, An Argument for a Negotiated Settlement to the War in Afghanistan. In 2013, he published The World's Most Dangerous Place, which dealt with Somalia and its diaspora, and the security threat that the newest battlefront against Al-Qaeda poses to the West. As I mentioned, the subject of this interview is the 2007 book, The Vitamin Murders, Who Killed Healthy Eating in Britain, which concerns the mysterious death of Sir Jack Drummond, Britain's top government food scientist during World War II, and, I might add, his wife and daughter. It was shortlisted for the Andre Simon Award for Gastronomic Literature. His website is jamesferguson.info, and that's Ferguson with two S's. Welcome to the show, James. I'm very pleased to have you with me today. I had read that book fairly recently, and it seems like one of the things that motivated you was your own concern about your own diet, I think when your wife was having your first child, is that right?
Exactly right. And my wife is a foodie anyway, so food was, we'd just been married not for very long, so food kind of loomed quite large in our lives at that time. And this is a while ago now, this is 10 years back. Talking about diet and wondering about the new baby, our firstborn,
And I think there's really two themes in this book, and we'll get to the murder mystery part of it, but I think your concerns were, and I think a lot of people have these concerns, is first eating better food, like a better balance of carbohydrates, fats, minimal sugar, stuff like that. And then there's the question of what's in the food that we don't really want at all, like pesticides and things like that. Those were both concerns for you?
Yeah, I mean, it did. I mean, the more I started, I'd never really looked at food before. I hadn't been particularly interested in food before that. In fact, I had a very kind of mechanical attitude towards food. I was, you know, as a single man, there were many things to me, and I kind of regard eating like filling up a car. You know, it's just a thing that you have to do to stop being hungry. But the moment you start thinking properly about food and what you're putting into your mouth, it's kind of amazing. You start just reading the labeling on packaging, and you start thinking, well, where's this all going? And the more I dug around, what was so interesting was that, you know, we food has become very cheap and convenient. But there's a big price for this, and it's not, you know, of course there has to be. Even in my lifetime, food which used to be maybe a treat on Sundays, like chicken. We used to have chicken, you know, it was a Sunday roast, and somewhere along the line in my lifetime, it became kind of a junk food. And you thought, how did that happen? You start to, and certain kinds of fish, like salmon is another one, the farmed salmon was total luxury when I was a kid. Now it's sort of, you get it in any sandwich store, really. And so something has changed in our lifetimes of the food production and the way that it gets onto our plate. But you don't necessarily think about it all the time.
Well, I mean, in some ways, it's good that people have more access to higher quality protein and things like that. But on the other hand, there's a lot more access to junk food. And I mean, let's get into part of the book, which was this man who ended up getting murdered, Sir James Drummond, I think was his name. Sir Jack Drummond. Mm-hmm. He was in charge of the British diet basically during World War II. And so can you kind of put that in context, or most of the listeners were probably, well, I wasn't born in World War II, so most people, I imagine, don't remember what the British did.
Yeah, he's an obscure scientist anyway. But what it was, I mean, he was a Victorian. He was born in the 1890s and he was an academic in London who got very interested in the whole question of vitamins at a time when, well, the science of vitamins was in its infancy. And so what Jack did through his university in London was to kind of popularize vitamins. So until Jack Drummond came along, you know, things like vitamin C, which we now know today, was known as anti-scorbutic factor, you know, this kind of thing. He was a great popularizer of vitamins. The vitamin A, B, C, D system that we have today was really his. And in fact, the word vitamin was coined by him. Before him, it was known as vitamine with an E in the end of it. And he kind of said, that's all hopeless. It's too scientific. People need vitamins. And one way of doing that is to make, you know, come up with a system that people can understand. And that's what we have today. So, he's important in the sort of history of nutrition. What happened, first of all, in World War One, Britain suffered very greatly from nutrition. And the part of the reason that was the U-boats. And we imported all the food, mostly from America. In fact, it came across the Atlantic. And once the U-boat war got going, in both of the wars, you know, this was a threat to the food import system. But when World War II came along, the government thought, we can't have this again. We've got to switch to being self-sufficient, because otherwise the U-boats will be defeated by Hitler within a couple of years. And so there's this massive switch towards self-sufficiency. They call it the Dig for Victory campaign, where everyone was encouraged to grow their own food. And there were lots of kind of public relations things, like, you know, Lord's cricket pitch was dug up and planted with wheat, that kind of thing. But alongside this, so food production went up massively, and it was very successful. I think the stats were something like, before World War II, we were importing 2/3 of our food and growing about 1/3 of it. By the end of World War II, it was the other way around. You're growing 2/3 of it and importing 1/3 or less. So it was an amazing sort of revolution in where the food actually came from. Mm-hmm. So with all of that, that was a big change. But alongside that, there had to be some science in how the food was going to be delivered, i.e. by the ration, because food was going to have to be rationed. Everyone was going to stay healthy. It had to be parceled out properly. And that's where Jack Drummond came in. He was called in as this academic, you know, this is his great moment, academic nutrition in London, was called in by the Ministry of Food, Special Ministry of Food, which had been set up at the beginning of World War II. And he designed the ration diet, and he did it on scientific principles. So he's the guy that worked out, the first person ever to work out how many calories we all need, the ideal number of calories, which I forget exactly. I think it's 2,000 for men, something like that, and maybe 1,800 calories per day for women, that kind of thing. So he designed this ration, a balanced diet, fruit, veg, the five fruit and veg a day thing that we still have today. That was him from World War II. And it was hugely successful, because there was obviously no obesity by the end of World War II. That was something that we didn't have. But there were all kinds of other maladies that kind of amazingly disappeared with the introduction of a healthy diet.
And, like diabetes, you know, went down?
Like diabetes, related to obesity, of course. But there were other things too, like things like rickets and all those sort of vitamin deficiency diseases kind of took a nosedive, because people were getting enough through the basic ration.
So if you were middle class, then probably the amount of food you consumed went down. But if you were poor, you might actually be eating more food, and certainly a greater variety of food.
I guess there was a great democratizing factor to all of this. Yes, I think that's probably true. But it wasn't just the quantities. It was also about the kind of, you know, the nutrient content of the food too. So it's the balance of the diet was really the point. You know, the meat and two veg thing. You know, until then, a lot of working classes would subsist on chips. You know, I mean,
right.
Potatoes only and no fruit. And this was kind of, so, you know, that the balance of the diet was very important.
And so, yeah. The amount of sugar consumed probably went down dramatically, right? Because that was not...
Sugar, yeah, exactly. Sugar went down a lot. And we all know now, particularly kind of, the health risks of too much sugar, right. It did go down a great deal. I mean, we know this. Well, I know this from my own father, who's in his 80s now, and he grew up during the war, and he retains this amazing sort of kind of worship of sweets and chocolate because he didn't have any as a kid. You know,
that was
free for him, and it's that same with bananas. Actually, there were no bananas around because they came from the Caribbean.
Right, right.
So no one got bananas during the war. But yeah, funny actually how your formative years kind of stay with you in terms of what you like to eat. It's
yeah,
interesting.
I actually grew up in England and moved to Canada while I was a child. But in university, I wrote a paper on sugar. I had to write it was a course on economic uses of plants or something. And so I just picked sugar kind of randomly. But what I learned, it still shocks me today, that the average English person at those days was eating 125 pounds of sugar a year or something like this, a huge quantity. Yeah. And also that sugar was hidden in so many of our foods, which most people I don't think realize. If you buy salad dressing, it's probably got sugar in it.
Exactly.
Sauces have a lot of sugar in it, things like
hidden,
that.
Hidden sugar, that's right, that's right. Exactly. So, well, that all went. Well, I guess the ration diet of World War II was very plain by modern standards. It wouldn't have tasted very much, I don't think, but not to our modern palate. But it was definitely healthy.
And there were lots of, like, people had lots of tricks to make do with substitutes. My parents lived through the Second World War in England, and I remember they had an old cookbook, which was like a Second World War cookbook about how you could substitute for coffee or you could substitute for this and that because people didn't have certain ingredients, so they'd figure out alternatives.
That's right. And of course, waste was considered almost immoral in World War II. I mean, nothing was waste. Everything was, you know, you make kind of, you know, you peel your potatoes and keep the peelings and do something with them afterwards as well, you know, all of that.
Right.
So sure, yeah.
Yes, and I guess the British love of gardening, I'm sure most people had a little, if they had any land at all, would be planting vegetables instead of flowers.
I think that's right, yeah. Window boxes full of vegetables, exactly.
Yes. Yeah. Well, they look kind of nice. Was this politically controversial? Because Britain had a conservative government during World War II, and I try to think of your current treasurer, Jack Osborne, what's his, is that his name?
George Osborne?
George Osborne. I try to think of him coming out with a program where everybody in England would eat the same thing, and I have a hard time imagining such a thing.
Well, but it's interesting, isn't it? We're just having this week, there's this introduction of a sugar tax, and this is the first time that's happened. And in the last budget, it's really quite, you know, it goes right the way back to the 1940s. It's the sort of thing that Jack Drummond would have approved of, actually.
Right, right.
Here we are. It's amazing.
Right. But I mean, did some people in the conservative government say kind of take the Ayn Rand position of the poor are poor because it's their fault and we shouldn't be feeding them? Or did they kind of say we need these people to work in our factories so they'd better have enough food to be good workers?
You mean back in World War II?
Yeah, yeah. Like was there any political pushback from some of the more right-wing elements of the Conservative Party?
I don't think so. I have to say, I mean, I think it's one of those, well, I don't know, truth and myth kind of get mixed up, don't they?
Right.
But you know, there was a very strong sense of, you know, we're all in this together.
Right.
Kind of thing during the war. I mean, that did happen. So I kind of, I mean, I suppose it's true that, you know, a healthy population is a healthy workforce, and it's for the factories and for soldiers too. It certainly had been a problem earlier on in the century. There's this amazing story about the army trying to recruit soldiers for the Boer War back in the 1890s.
Right.
And it was struggling to find enough people to fill the ranks because there was a minimum height requirement to be a soldier, which was something tiny. It was like 5'3".
Right.
And they couldn't find enough people because I think they were recruiting in Wales. So particularly bad, you know, a lot of malnutrition among miners there.
Right.
You know, the coal miners, and they actually reduced the the minimum height requirement from 5'3" to 5 foot.
Wow.
In order to fill the ranks, which tells you something about malnutrition and kind of stunting through bad diets.
Right. This wasn't a genetic. This was about pygmies. This was just bad diet.
It's extraordinary. I mean, really small people, and I guess they weren't all miners, but I mean, small people kind of work. They get our minds quite nicely, don't they? But it's a terrible indictment of the state of the nation in terms of its health. And that was the late Victorian period. That's where we were at. And the Boer War generals were having trouble filling the ranks.
Right. So after World War II, Drummond kind of, I guess, lost his job, right? In this sense, there was rationing ended, I think, in the late 40s. It didn't end at the end of the war.
Actually, no. Full rationing didn't end until almost the mid-50s. They kept it for a very, very long time afterwards because the post-year wars were ones still of terrible austerity. And the import-export, luxury goods particularly kind of didn't get going again properly for a long time. And meat production, I think it was beef actually was the last thing to come off the ration in the mid-1950s, partly because a lot of beef and a lot of what we were producing was being exported to Germany, weirdly enough, because Germany was even worse, much worse state than we were in. They were starving over there as part of the reconstruction of Europe. So there was this kind of rather socialist kind of attempt to, the reconstruction of Europe, kind of everyone had to kind of make sacrifices long after the war. But he did lose his job. Yes, you're right. And it was this terrible era of austerity. And he did this rather extraordinary move for somebody who'd been first an academic, then a rather admired public servant. He went into private industry. He went and worked for Boots, Boots the pharmaceutical.
And to give a little context for people who aren't English, I mean, Boots, they have pharmacies on basically every street corner in England. They're still like that?
They're still here, yeah. It's still a major pharmaceutical chemist chain. Every supermarket, every high street has a Boots, and it sells, it's where you get your toothpaste.
And they also manufacture a lot of stuff, too. It's not just retail stores, right?
Well, they're more retail these days, but when he joined in the 50s, they were very much in manufacturing too, and they were into pharmacology. I mean, they were developing drugs and developing, interestingly, agricultural products. And this is the pesticides and herbicides, which my book is very much about. I mean, my book is really a history of the development of agrochemicals, and that's what Jack Drummond went to do. He went to work in the agrochemical research department of Boots in the 1950s, and that's strange because it was an unusual thing to do for an academic and a public servant to go into the private sector in that way. It's not like nowadays. I mean, he did it for the money, but everyone kind of, why on earth is he doing that? It seems a strange thing to do.
Right. World War II, during World War II, DDT was used, it was a military secret, but after World War II, all of these things became public, and everybody thought pesticides were wonderful after World War II, for at least a few years before people start to realize the downside of them.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, the war ended, and the continent was on its knees, and there were millions of people starving everywhere, and they needed feeding.
Right.
And agrochemicals and they've been developed during the war to kind of boost production, but they've been wildly successful. And it continued after the war because there was an imperative to feed people. And this was the great hope, is that you could double, triple, quadruple your production, your yields by using chemicals. This was the great sort of leap forward for technology exactly. And it went ahead without very much regulation. And people said, it doesn't matter, just grow. We've got to feed all these people.
Right, and I don't think there was much opposition back then. I mean, Rachel Carson was the 1960s, right, when she wrote her books.
And, that's right, exactly.
People like that. So there weren't a lot of people saying we shouldn't be spraying DDT or whatever on our fields. It took a few years for people to notice that when you sprayed DDT, there were no birds left and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's right. People didn't really, if there were side effects, they tended to overlook them because of the advantages of maximizing your yield were so great. And it took a while to, for people to realize. And that was the story with chemicals generally, I think. You know, for all of that post-war period, I mean, think about thalidomide, actually. I mean,
yes.
Waste agrochemicals.
Yes.
But I mean, there was the testing regime was much laxer than it is today. Much laxer. Yeah,
although these things still slip through. I know in Canada we have our own drug that seems very similar to thalidomide, and the government won't release documentation on it. So, but anyway, that's a whole other story. But it seems reasonable to take a positive view of what Drummond did. I mean, he might have thought that, okay, during World War II, we sort of balanced the British diet. Now we've got a bit more, you know, now we can face a time of prosperity. We should be producing more. We've got these big needs of countries that are being destroyed that need. I mean, was he just doing it for the money, or did he sort of genuinely believe that the pesticides would actually help people without understanding the downside?
Well, I mean, it's kind of confusing because he did warn publicly in a lecture or in a paper anyway, for sure, written, that he said, you know, these new chemicals are not being tested properly, and, you know, we need to be careful because there could be side effects to this stuff which we don't know about. You know, but at the same time, he was developing or working on the development of chemicals which turned out to be precisely some of those chemicals that have those side effects. Mostly chlorine-based ones. I mean, chlorine was the great building block of the agrochemical revolution. That was the one that. So there were all sorts of. I mean, DDT was chlorine-based, I think.
And yeah, it was.
All those things like 2,4-D and dichlorprop.
2,4-5-T. Yes.
All of those, exactly. And the defoliants, of course. You know, the Agent Orange stuff is all. I think that's.
That was 2,4-5-T and 2,4-D, I believe, as well as and a lot of other junk as well, but chlorine-based, yeah, for sure.
Mm. You know, it's kind of ambivalent why he was doing it. When I was researching the book, I did talk to people who were pretty old, but one or two did find who remembered Jack Drummond. And, you know, they said, no, of course he was, you know, he was, they insisted that he was actually a philanthropist and was doing it for the good of the world and people, all the rest of it. But there are equally people that said, but you know, you know, his salary must have gone up by a factor of 10. It surely was a part of it. Looking for payback for a lifetime in penniless academia, I think. He's no hero, you know.
Right. I think if somebody offers you a huge salary and then also tells you that you're going to do wonderful things for the world, there's a tendency to kind of close your eyes to the little questions inside you yourself. If this is so wonderful, why am I getting paid so much?
I think there was some of that with him, probably. Yeah.
Yes.
And he did his bit, you know. I mean, he'd done his bit in the war, and he had certainly, you know, in the great scales of, if he ever ends up sort of in front of St. Peter and he's being measured up, he'd be in credit, I think.
Well, yeah, I guess to the British survival in World War II, I mean, there were a number of things, but the ability to feed the population was certainly a huge. Part of
I think a thing. I mean, not to be sneered at all. I mean, you know, I mean, his legacy lives on. We don't appreciate him, as I was saying, you know, the popularization of vitamins, the five fruit and veg a day. I mean, the principle of a balanced, healthy diet dates from that period, and he was a very big player in developing that.
Yes, yes. So he went to France supposedly on holiday, and now we get to kind of the mystery part of it. So he gets in the car. He had a daughter or a son.
He had a daughter, one 10-year-old daughter, who he'd had by quite late in life. He'd divorced his wife and had an affair with his secretary, and they'd had a baby together, and they'd gone off on holiday. And this is the mystery. And they drove all the way down France, ostensibly on a camping holiday. They were going to stay with some friends in the south of France on the way as well. So down he goes, driving down to the south of France, and he ends up. I mean, you know, to cut a long story short, he was murdered at the side of the road, camping, along with his wife and 10-year-old daughter. Kind of on the back end of this tiny little farm on a back road, way down south of France, in the Chateau Arnoux region. There are so many sort of unexplained aspects to the murder, and it's a very famous murder case in France, even now, if you ask any Frenchman, do you know, it's known as L'affaire Dominici, And you just mention those words, and every Frenchman will say, oh, yes, I remember that. It's been televised and turned into films. And, you know, it was never solved very satisfactorily.
So, I mean, did they get somebody? And do you think it was...
No, they did. They did. I mean, they eventually arrested the local farmer, the man, Gaston Dominici, he was called, was the man whose land the Drummonds had camped on. Now, the Dominici family were certainly implicated in this in some way. But whether, you know, he was an old farmer, the classic sort of clog-wearing, you know, panniel kind of stereotype, you know, man of the soil, you know, sort of son of the soil type. And, you know, whether he actually committed the murder was never really satisfactorily proved. There was the police messed up the investigation. They were late on the scene. The evidence was tampered with. And there's lots of suggestion that maybe it was not Dominici, the father, but possibly the son had been involved with this and another neighbor. Anyway, the dad was tried as this tremendous celebrity trial. One right. of the great... One of the first, it's considered one of the first kind of media trials, and the press descended on this thing from
right.
The French press, so the English press, and they kind of screwed it up too. And he was actually pardoned. Dominici was tried and found guilty, but then subsequently pardoned by de Gaulle.
Did de Gaulle give a reason for pardoning a murderer?
Not really, other than that he was he was a very old man. I mean, he was approaching the end of his life anyway. But it was, I mean, that added to the sense of conspiracy around it.
Yes.
Did de Gaulle do this because, you know, he was a son of the soil, the evidence had never been very satisfactory? Don't know. I mean, strange thing to have released him, but he was quietly released and he finished his days in a hospice.
Right. And there was, if I remember correctly, there was like a big chemical manufacturing plant so not too far from this site.
Right. Well, I mean, there are numerous theories as to why, you know, first of all, what he was doing in that area and why he was murdered, you know, whether there was something more to this than a kind of a casual alcohol-fueled murder. That was what it looked like from the outset.
But, oh, I see. He gets drunk. He gets mad. Somebody's on his land.
story. Someone had come and tried to sort of spy on his wife while she was changing, and there was a fight, and it got out of hand. And,
oh, okay.
There's more to it than that, because the murders themselves were so vicious. I mean,
right.
And particularly of the daughter, this poor 10-year-old daughter who was clubbed to death with a rifle.
Wow.
You know, I mean, it's really kind of... And it looked, there are lots of things that make you think that maybe it wasn't kind of quite as it seemed. But anyway, the first thing is this factory, as you say, which was maybe 10, 15 miles down the road.
Right.
A place called Chateau Arnoux, which was, it still is indeed, a huge chlorine factory.
Right.
And I had a look at this factory. I took a tour of it. It's a very interesting place. It was built in a huge hurry in 1918. In order to make chlorine gas for battlefield use against the Germans.
As a chemical weapon.
As a chemical weapon.
Right.
And it shows you, and after the war, there was this huge factory making chlorine, but no need for chlorine gas anymore.
Right.
It then converted to manufacture of agrochemicals.
Right.
Of the type, you know, chlorine-based agrochemicals of exactly the same type that Drummond was involved in manufacturing and researching for Boots back in England. And the more I looked at this, the more I discovered that actually this factory was completely cutting edge in its day for what it was developing. Had a lot of money from the US, actually, kind of Marshall Plan money was going into France. And so I began to work in this theory, and it is, I confess, no more than a theory, but it's an intriguing one, that actually Drummond had been there to spy on the factory, effectively, and that what had happened was that he'd been there. You know, the holiday was kind of a cover for what he was really doing, which was to drop in this factory, meet a contact, and collect industrial secrets from this factory. Something went wrong along the way. I mean, one of the things about where they were murdered, where the campsite was strangely close to quite a busy road. And if you were camping, why would you do that? You could, you know, he was an experienced camper. He was always hiking, Drummond. He knew how to find a nice spot, and
right.
You know, If he'd gone another 50 yards or 100 yards, he would have been right by a little river and a lovely spot. But no, he's right on the side of the road, which suggests that he was there to meet somebody. It was a rendezvous of some kind. Maybe the pickup, maybe this was where he's going to meet his contact to swap the secrets. Who knows? That kind of thing. But if you were hoping to stop at the side of a road and meet someone that was coming down the road by car at night, that's exactly where you would park. The car right. was parked where you couldn't miss it at the apex of a bend and so on.
Right, right.
You know, it was a fun theory to kick around, and there are plenty of people in France who when you lay this theory out, they go, yes, that's exactly right.
Yeah. Oh, really?
Stories which kind of just pulls in conspiracies, and you know, the French love a conspiracy theory anyway.
So I guess the question is, if he must have had, I mean, if this is true, there must have been somebody inside the plant who was going to presumably sell him this information, and then things that could go wrong. Maybe there was a bunch of money in the car.
Well, not necessarily sell, because this was 1952, when this was communism. This is very communist country down there. It always had always been so. The partisans, you know, the Maquisards,
right.
mm-hmm. Had been very socialist oriented, and you know, the Cold War was getting going by 1952, and socialism, communism was extremely strong down there. So there may have been a Cold War element to this, because don't forget, chlorine wasn't just used for agrochemicals; it also had, at the time, unknown potential military application. Which, of course, we then saw in Vietnam with Agent Orange. I mean, it's all
right.
chlorine technology, which, you know. So both sides of the Cold War were very interested in chlorine technology for its potential battlefield use. So it could have been that, you know, Drummond was working in some capacity for the government, for the security services. They needed to get their hands on this kind of cutting-edge chlorine technology for their own use against and take it away from the communists. And this is a classic kind of Cold War weapons plot.
Oh, I see. Because I mean, I think of France as a Western country, but I mean, a lot of those European countries, the resistance was often communists and socialists,
right?
And it was the right wing in France that collaborated with the Nazis. So maybe
right, exactly.
the British were afraid that the French would become communist and become part of the Soviet bloc.
They were very frightened of it. It was a very real possibility, and this is early 1950s, when it was very far from clear that the Iron Curtain was going to stay where it did. I mean, there was every possibility that it might even stretch a little bit further into Western Europe and take in parts of Southern France. And that was
right.
There are all these stories about kind of hidden arms caches left over from the war, which were going to be kind of pulled out of hiding and used in a communist revolution when the time came. You know,
right.
It's a very fraught time for a lot of people. Yeah,
I think there's arm caches on both sides. I've read a lot of Italian books, and it seems like everyone that's in from the modern era has the left versus right theme. You know, the mafia, on the right hand side with a bunch of other unsavory elements, and then the dyed-in-the-wool communists on the other side who are probably just as unsavory.
Exactly. So you could have had, you know, a French, all of the workers in the chlorine factory, incidentally, they were all local, and they had all been in the Mackie. I mean, they'd all been working for the,
right.
I think, the FTP, or there were various kind of Mackie-Zaire factions, but they were all kind of very red, very, very, very left-wing.
Right.
So you've got a very communist workforce, but there may well have been workers there who didn't agree with communism and thought, well, we've got to get these, you know, we're making something here, which might end up in Moscow. We've got to make sure that it gets to London. So, you know, I mean, it's a fun theory, and it's very difficult to prove any of this stuff.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's one theory. The other is that there could have been somebody who would do anything for money.
I guess. I mean, I accept that there are other connections. I mean, so Boots was not only a commercial company, or rather, what it was, but at the time, some of the guys running Boots, I've forgotten the name of his man now. He's called, anyway, I've forgotten. The number two at Boots had previously been running British intelligence during the war. So there was a connection to the security establishment in London through Boots. So you kind of think, well, maybe, you know, maybe he was, and also, I mean, the other thing that was going on then was that in the 50s, it was very difficult to travel abroad. You had to get,
right.
You couldn't just take off very easily. You had to, for one thing, petrol was rationed.
Right.
So you couldn't drive very far, and it was difficult. It was expensive to travel. People didn't really go abroad very much.
Right.
To get permission and so on. But Drummond, as a sort of, you know, researcher for a big international drugs company, had the perfect excuse, really, and possibly cover, to travel around Europe kind of asking rather technical questions about chemicals. I mean, it's sort of perfect sort of cover if you're kind of doing it for somebody else.
Yes. Yeah. And I think it's true that if you work for the security forces, you never actually really leave, that you are going to be an asset for them for the rest of your life.
Yeah, once you're in, you're in for good. That's right. Yeah.
Yes. So that is a little bit
anyway,
suspicious.
But who knows? I mean, the murder was never properly solved, and all of this is kind of, you know, like, it's my own sort of slightly pet theory, I have to say, you know, but it's intriguing, and it just, that whole part of France has such a sort of strong atmosphere to it, and, you know, it was very strange in the 1950s, and I've met people dead now who recall what it was like then. I mean, everyone was still armed. I mean, everyone, the war hadn't been ended for very long, and everyone had a gun under their bed, and there's lots of revenge going on, lots of killings, you know, because people who'd been in the Maquis, people who collaborated, you know, the kind of revenge killings went on for years after the war. So it's quite a violent, dark kind of place, and very poor, and you mix in lots of kind of strange politics and so on and so on. So, you know, anything is possible around there.
Right. But if there was an insider, then was there ever anybody identified as the potential...
The hander on a secret?
Yeah.
No. No, I'm afraid there wasn't.
I guess after that murder, whoever was going to hand over secrets probably kept his mouth pretty shut.
Yeah, and no secrets were ever found in the car, which is what you'd expect. Well, maybe, unless the switcheroo had gone wrong and they'd taken them on. But the thing is that the press got to the car, you know, this kind of abandoned car with dead bodies lying around it. I mean, for hours before the police did, and they crawled all over it and they removed things and was like, "Oh, look, Inspector, I found this. Is this important?" kind of thing. And
so
all the forensics had kind of gone to pot.
It reminds me of the San Bernardino shooting where the landlord let the press in and they're like picking stuff up, taking photos of it. It's like, oh my God,
right.
This is a crime scene.
It was very like that. It was kind of, you know, Inspector Clouseau sort of stuff going on. It was a disaster.
Yeah.
But there are lots of stories of sort of strange things happening. The murder was obviously in the middle of the night.
Right.
And there were reports of cars coming and going and someone disappearing and people looking for Drummond and never. I don't know, it's just all sorts of rumor kind of flying around. The main sort of investigator of this stuff was one of the Domenici family, the grandson of the man who was eventually arrested, has spent most of his life... He's a judo instructor, kind of at a school, kind of down
right.
that way. But he's obsessed with this thing, absolutely obsessed with the case.
And he's convinced his grandfather's innocent?
Convinced of his grandfather's innocence and has spent most of his life trying to prove that. So he's the man you go to. He's got these, you know, classic obsessive, really. I mean, kind of, you know, all the books and charts everywhere kind of showing, you know, all the possible things that might have happened. And you kind of think, you know, after talking to him for a bit, you have to think, well, look, you know, you let the obsession take over you. And there's a kind of a danger of that with this story because it has all the elements of a... You know, I got obsessed with it myself. I completely got that. And eventually you just have to let it drop because it's never really going to be solved. And there are so many variables in the thing that you know...
Right. And I guess the good thing about writing a book is that once you finish the book, you kind of can let go.
Yeah. And I had to. And it did become completely sort of... I don't know. The murder mystery was fun, but the other half of it was this business of agrochemicals, which really is a kind of a serious question. But it is a fact that the average Westerner now has measurable traces of 300 man-made chemicals in their body,
right.
Whereas before 1945, none of those chemicals would have been in the average
right.
body because they didn't exist. They've all been invented since, you know,
yes.
their products, the agrochemical revolution. And that is pretty interesting. And I that was the other line of my inquiry, you know, kind of to find out what it was that was in my body and how it had got there. And I had myself tested, and indeed my poor wife, and her breast milk. She was breastfeeding at the time.
Right.
And her breast milk had DDT in it, and it had all this stuff in it, which has been banned since the 1970s, but it's
right.
still there.
Right.
Fat soluble, and these things, I mean, tiny quantities of them.
Right.
But they are, technically carcinogenic. And as when you mix, as you mix one chemical with another one, you get something else. And if there's 300 of these things in your body,
it's impossible.
You're never going to be able to test it because of all the possible permutations. And your body's a kind of an unregulated test tube for an agrochemical experiment that's been going on for 50 years. And, you look around the world and things like cancer, and there are all sorts of kind of diseases and maladies which have gone up. And no one quite knows why. There could be lots of reasons for it, but you've got to think that the agrochemicals in our bodies might well be one of them. It seems to be worth it.
Well, like I was saying earlier, I think there's the two aspects. Like, it's like we should be eating more fruits and vegetables. We should be eating less sugar or even no sugar if you're disciplined enough for that. But at the same time, you might be eating fruits and vegetables that have been sprayed with pesticides that haven't been properly washed, or that the pesticides are absorbed inside them. It seems to me, since I left England many, many years ago, that a lot of British people are eating organic and are becoming much more conscious of the second aspect of food, of like the chemicals that are in it.
Yeah, I think they are. The organic food industry here is, I don't know, it hasn't completely taken over, that's for sure. It's much more expensive than people, I guess it's kind of a middle-class luxury, but, the rise of the farmer's market is definitely there, and I guess people are eating better, but it is a class thing too. And there are plenty of people that don't get anywhere near the recommended 5 fruit and veg a day. I mean, God knows. I mean, when here in Scotland, I mean, there is a very serious sort of obesity problem and some very bad diets around still, and a great difference between the middle classes and the, I think it's in Scotland. There's just to the east of Glasgow, somewhere like, was it Renfrewshire or Dunbarton, somewhere around there. But, the average life expectancy is different by about 20 years going from an affluent class bit to a working class bit. And it's purely about diet.
And a huge amount of obesity in the working class is due to the consumption of over-refined carbohydrates.
Correct, yeah. And hidden sugars and the rest of it. Yeah.
I don't follow cooking television shows, but isn't it Jamie Oliver who's been trying to revise the British diet? I remember hearing of a school that like banned junk food, and they reformed their cafeteria, and there were mothers coming up to the fence with like chips
I may have even put that in the book. It's 10 years ago now. He had this great campaign to improve school food, and he had some success with it. Because it was something that I think the government should certainly have been doing, but they weren't. And they had to respond to this public TV campaign, which is a very good one. I'm like, good for him. But that's right. There's classic sort of, I've seen it, the classic footage of mothers kind of going, Darren's not getting enough he's not getting
enough chips.
And shoving kind of rubbish through the kind of school, right through the barriers of the school playground. I think it's in London, that school.
Yes, I don't know how you. I mean, it's partly our society, but there's a lot of education, and I also think people think that eating better is. A lot of people think eating better is going to be boring, but it's actually more interesting. The more you learn about food, the more enjoyment you get out of it. If you're always eating fish and chips and curry, if that's like your entire, expanse of your diet, that's actually pretty boring.
Yeah. It's amazing how conservative people are. We have a restaurant here in Edinburgh that we take the kids to sometimes because they love it. It's a place called Cosmo. It's a small chain and really successful. And Cosmo works by, it gives you options. So you can go in one restaurant, you can have, Chinese or kind of curry or, it's got every kind of cuisine in the world. And it's cheap. It's like kind of eating on a cruise liner, it feels a bit like that. But what's interesting is you go in there, a lot of the customers are hugely obese because you can eat as much as you like for a flat.
Yeah.
But second of all is that even when people are given this choice of kind of, you know, the world, you know, you can go and experiment and have any kind of, the number of people that go up and say, well, I think I'll just have chips today, you know, and they do, you know, you see all these kind of fat people kind of eating kind of junk.
Yes.
And that's all on offer, but, you know, and you could have, you can have, you know, kind of cooked to order kind of
stir fry, Asian stir fry or something.
And beautiful kind of squid and chili sauce and all this stuff. And they don't touch it. They just don't like it. They just kind of, they stick with what they know. And isn't that interesting? I mean, people are very kind of strange about food sometimes.
Yeah. And I guess during the Second World War, I mean, people were forced to eat different things. I mean, if you're hungry, that might be when you eat a turnip for the first time, even though you've said you're never going to eat a turnip.
I think there probably was some of that. Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, in the war, I mean, I don't, you know, I mean, the idea of a perfectly evenly distributed ration is a very nice democratic idea, but of course it didn't really happen like that.
No.
I mean, if you lived in the country, you had access to food that people in the city didn't.
Right.
You'd go and, you know, go and shoot yourself a rabbit, I suppose, but you could grow, you know, there's more fruit and veg around. And so I do know people that were, as kids, grew up in the country and don't really remember the effect of rationing because it was sort of all, you know, it was all kind of carry on as usual.
Yeah.
And there was corruption too. I mean, if you had money, you could kind of get anything you wanted, as if you're prepared to pay black market rates for it.
Right. One of my grandfathers worked in a food market, so I'm sure he got lots of things that fell off the back of the truck. And my other grandparents had a little house in London, but it had a big garden. And although my grandfather was away at the war, I'm sure that my grandmother was like filling it with vegetables. She wasn't quite the gardener of my grandfather, but I'm sure she was planting lots.
There's a lot of stuff you could do around the sides if you wanted to.
But if you were living in the slums, I guess you didn't have any of those options.
Yeah, but you had your ration book and you could go along and you got what you were given. And
right. And
that was probably an improvement on the sort of, you know, who knows what they were eating in the kind of back end of Liverpool kind of in 1935. It wouldn't have been great, would it? You know, so.
Right. I mean, it was kind of the end of the slums in England, wasn't it? I mean, a lot of them got bombed and the kids got moved out of the city, at least temporarily. I think World War II made a huge difference to the poor in England.
Yeah, I think it did, and the kids, particularly, kind of being evacuated out of London and, you know, going to work on the land. I mean, they were sent to farms and the land girls and all of that. So I guess it was a kind of a byproduct of the war, was a sort of a reconnection of the city population with the countryside that used to feed them.
Right.
So there was a lot of collective nutritional knowledge was kind of taken on board. As a result of the war, in a funny kind of way. Everyone knew how to cook in those days, you see, and there was this great kind of public program to teach people how to cook, and you had these TV programs, public information, public service broadcasting, endless cookery programs, showing housewives how to make a nice pie and all the rest of it. But great, because everyone could actually do basic cooking, you know, domestic science, as it used to be called.
Right. I remember my mother, who's still alive, saying, like, in England, they were taught to weigh everything, which is a better way to cook. But in North America, still, everything's by volume, right? A cup of this, a cup of that, teaspoon, tablespoon. And my mother would always say, that's just the wrong way to do it. It's like you have to weigh things. You don't know how much you have unless you weigh it.
Well, I mean, but this is a kind of it's like a sort of a kind of body of knowledge that you sort of take on almost instinctively, and mothers will teach their daughters particularly how to cook, you know. I mean, you know, but we've lost that, and that's the thing. I mean, that it lasted maybe two generations, maybe three, just about people kind of teaching their kids how to do it, how to make a sponge cake, whatever. But it's all gone. I mean, now we now live in a world where I think it's been a while, maybe 15, 20 years now, but the number of new houses that had kitchens was outnumbered by houses that didn't. I mean, people don't have kitchens anymore.
Right, they all have like a microwave and...
You have a microwave, you have a kind of a breakfast bar where you kind of, somewhere you perch and eat a bowl of cereal, but a proper kitchen with a kitchen table or a dining room with a dining table, I mean, come on, that's disappeared. It's a waste of space now because the family doesn't gather around for a family meal in the way that it used to do. And that is all part of the revolution of agrochemicals. And what it did was to drive food down in price so much that it became something, you know, food is very cheap, you don't value it.
Right.
If you don't value food, then you don't value the process of eating. I mean, there's nothing, you know, the enjoyment in a of cheap food is somehow much less than if you've had to pay a lot of money for it as a proportion of your salary, which
yeah.
is lower than it's ever been, you know.
Yeah, of course, if you if it, it's it, to me it's like salad dressing. It's like if you know how to make salad dressing, as oil, vinegar, salt, basically that's your basic ingredients. It takes you less time than it takes you to go to the store and get some, and yet most people wouldn't even conceive of making their own salad dressing because they just think it's some really complicated thing that has to be done in a $1 million factory.
That's right. That's right. I mean, there's so much pre-preparation stuff, and it's just sort of junk. And you know, and the net result of all this is that, I mean, the stats on how much food gets thrown away.
Yes.
Just horrible, you know.
Right.
That never happened in World War II, but I mean, it's like a third of all food production ends up past its sell-by date and going into the bin. I mean, it's just kind of horrendous amounts of waste and immoral, really.
I mean, right. I totally agree with you, and it's sad that people don't appreciate food enough to want to know more about it and to learn to explore food more.
But they would if they were paying more for it. They wouldn't throw it away, and they would appreciate it more if it was more expensive. So I would certainly, you know, it needs to be reversed. I mean, we need to, you know, I think food should be much more expensive than it is. And,
right, but then the poor wouldn't have enough food, so we'd be back to pre-World War II, where the...
I guess, except that, you know, I kind of doubt that. I mean, if you have to make sacrifices, food is the last thing that goes. And we talk about poverty. I mean, there's, you know, politicians always talk about poverty, but it's very relative, isn't it? I mean, you know, when you talk about poverty now, it's kind of people on benefits complaining about the cost of their flat screen telly, you know. I mean, it's a bit, it's kind of, you know, I don't think there is poverty in the sense that there used to be 50 years ago in this country. Anything like, you know, no one really dies of rickets anymore, or, you know, all this, those kind of Victorian diseases that people used to, you know, consume and stuff. It's just a, and I think we'd have to go a long way before, you know, we've gone too far in the direction of convenient food. You could peel it back a bit without pushing people, I suspect, quite a lot.
Yeah. Well, we kind of come towards the end of our time. Is there anything you'd like to add to this book? It's still available, right? It's still in print, this book?
Yeah, I think it is. And, I enjoy it. I mean, the murder hasn't been solved, and the issues of our diet are still very much alive. I mean, I guess what I'd add is that, I mean, when I was going through all of this, I became a bit of a food obsessive myself. And I'm not now. I sort of, that kind of period of my life passed. It was 10 years ago. But there is a legacy, which is that it did actually permanently alter the way that I eat to quite a big degree. So I don't exclusively eat organic food now, but fruit and veg, but I prefer it.
Right.
I buy it when I can, and I definitely do eat a more balanced diet than I used to. And you know, in terms of trying to, I think I do eat 5 fruit and veg every day now, which I certainly did in the old days, and that was kind of a result of thinking a little bit harder than I usually did about what you put in your mouths. And you should. You are what you eat. For heaven's sake, it's crazy to treat food like a. Like it's gas you're putting in a car. That would just be a mistake, you know. Because anyway, perhaps this comes with growing up a bit, and having kids actually, that does make you think about.
Yes, well, I mean, it's kind of true. If you go to Esso or Shell or whichever gas station, does it really make any difference to your car? But when it comes to food, it makes a big difference if you go to McDonald's or the organic grocery store.
It makes a huge difference. And, you know, I mean, you really do. And very quickly as well. I mean, if you change your diet, and I've been doing a lot of research at the moment on the Muslim community here in Britain. I'm hanging out with a lot of Pakistanis down in Bradford and Manchester, and they're all eating curries. And so days and days of eating kind of fried food and curries, you feel just really quite ill. Not used to it. I feel sort of sluggish, and after a few days, I start longing for something sort of, you know, just fresh veg and stuff. And you feel perkier. You feel your brain works better. You sleep better. And obviously, if you eat too much, you get obese, and that's about the worst thing in the world, I think. So, what you put in, you get out. It's important to eat well.
Yeah. Well, I hope people will get your book, The Vitamin Murders, and it's kind of nice in a way that it's not completed, in that the full truth is not known, so people can read it and speculate a little bit about what really did happen, the pieces that aren't known and maybe will never be known. But it's also joins together issues of food with this murder, and also the issue of nutrition versus chemicals in our food. So there's a lot of facets to the book. So I think that's why I liked it so much.
Good. I'm glad you did. And thank you very much for the chance to talk about it again. It's nice.
Yeah, and I'll send you a link to the MP3 of this podcast in a few days. And then you're welcome to put it on your website or whatever.
Cool, I'll do that. Yeah, I'll put a link on that for sure.
Okay.
Good, David.
Thank you
All
very
right.
much.
Thanks very much. Good to talk to you.
Okay, goodbye.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
Well, let's wrap up the show with some medical news. There's always something crazy in the world of medicine. A stat, which is a medical news website, reports a $100 million ad campaign by Gilead, the manufacturer of Harvoni, which is a hepatitis C treatment that costs $1,100 each pill. Gilead's strategy is to push Harvoni in front of potential patients through the regular media, science fiction shows, news. So what this means is that doctors say patients come in asking for this incredibly expensive drug, and sometimes it's paid for. They also run other ads that don't mention their two hepatitis C drugs, Harvoni and Salvatti, by name. But they urge patients to go to a website for more information, which of course tells you to see your doctor and mention Harvoni. And apparently, of the $100 million ad campaign, these ads are not included. So where are they getting this money from? Well, they've made $12 billion in sales of Harvoni, and the preceding drug, which is still sold, Sovaldi, has generated $11 billion. So I guess $100 million for an ad campaign, if it can generate a couple more billion dollars in sales of their drugs, is worthwhile. The medical website then says, this is really interesting because it's just not true, sales have been particularly brisk because the drugs work in the vast majority of patients. They can cure hepatitis C with few side effects in a matter of weeks, eliminating the potential need for grueling and expensive treatments like liver transplants later in life. The actual evidence is that being hepatitis C positive puts you at very small risk for liver disease if the associated factors like drug abuse, steroid abuse, are eliminated. So hepatitis C by itself seems to have very little impact on the liver. I will also post the link to an interesting discussion that I recently had on my podcast, How Positive Are You?, with my co-host Elizabeth Ely, interviewing Alastair MacKinnon, who was on some of the earlier hepatitis C therapies, which everybody admits are incredibly toxic. They didn't solve his liver cirrhosis problem, and he was basically told this was impossible, but he actually reversed it naturally on his own. So that is very interesting considering the incredibly expensive drugs that the American drug company Gilead is trying to push on everybody. Thank you for listening to episode 94 of The Infectious Myth. If you have a comment, question, or suggestion for a future guest, please email me at david.crow, crow with an E, @theinfectiousmyth.com, like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter @infectiousmyth. Until next week, goodbye.